All right, so you guys have really given us some food for thought this time around with all this material focusing on the whole question of miracles and really the arguments that people bring up against them. I think what we want to try and do today is kind of map out some of those major conversations, the philosophical and historical ones, and, you know, cut through some of that denseness to really get at the core of these objections.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're really talking about a deep dive into the arguments against the very possibility and plausibility of miracles.
Right.
And the material we're primarily using to navigate this is Dr. Robert C. Newman's session, where he's responding to liberal rejections of miracles.
All right.
So, you know, it gives us a good overview of some of the big challenges, and he touches on thinkers like Spinoza, Hume, Kant, Harnack, and Bultmann.
Wow, that's quite a lineup.
It is. And he also brings in some counter arguments that we find in the works of Geisler, Brown, and Grivet, and Habermas.
Okay, great. So you're saying by the time we get to the end of all of this, we're hoping that you, the listener, will have a much clearer sense of, I guess you could say, the intellectual heavy hitters that have come up against the idea of miracles over the years, and then also how those challenges have been addressed.
Right.
Kind of your shortcut to understanding this really dense intellectual territory.
That's the goal.
Awesome. Okay, let's jump right in. Let's unpack the first big one, which is the idea that miracles are just, boom, deductively impossible. And we're going to start with Spinoza.
Okay, so Spinoza, as Geisler kind of frames it, is essentially saying that miracles are violations of natural law, and those natural laws can't be changed. They're immutable.
Right.
So any violation of an unchangeable law, by definition, is impossible. It's very neat, very logical.
Yeah, it's very cut and dry, isn't it? It really does make you kind of stop and think. But what's the way to think about pushing back on that logic?
Well, one of the first things to think about is that not every miracle necessarily has to be a violation of a natural law in the way that Spinoza's thinking of it.
Okay.
Some might be more like an overriding of a law, you know, just in a particular instance.
Good.
So think of it like picking up a pen.
Yeah. Right.
You're overcoming gravity in that localized action.
Right.
You're not breaking the law of gravity, but you're applying another force.
Yeah, that's a really helpful way to visualize it. So it's not about just shattering these fundamental rules, but maybe just a different principle kind of taking over in that moment.
Exactly. And then the other thing to think about is, are these natural laws really immutable? Can they not be changed?
Right.
I mean, certainly from our perspective, you know, we look at gravity and it seems pretty constant.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere.
But, you know, can we really say with absolute certainty that those things can never be changed under any conceivable circumstance? Especially if you bring in the idea of a divine being that might be acting. You know, our scientific understanding of how the universe works is always evolving.
Right.
So to be absolutely certain about this seems a little premature.
Yeah. So that can't be changed piece. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not quite as settled as Spinoza would like to suggest.
And even that word violation, that's a really interesting one to think about, too, because what might be impossible for us with our current understanding and our limitations might not be for a being that is operating on, you know, on a whole different level.
Right. And that leads to another way that this deductive argument is sometimes framed, which is not just that miracles are violations, but that they're wrong violations, irrational violations.
Okay, lay that out for me. This sounds intriguing.
So the argument goes something like this. A miracle is a violation of natural law. To violate any kind of law means there's something wrong with it. It's either illegal, immoral, it's illogical, or it even could be just, you know, like violating an aesthetic principle.
Okay.
And since we say God is perfectly rational and moral, God wouldn't do things that are violations in that negative sense.
In fact, this line of reasoning actually opens the door to the possibility that maybe someone like Satan could perform miracles because he's not bound by goodness in the same way.
Wow, that's really interesting. So the act itself of breaking the rule is seen as inherently negative.
Right.
And since God is this perfect being who doesn't, you know, doesn't do negative things.
Well, then miracles are a problem.
Right, right. Okay. Is that, I mean, is that really what's going on here?
Well, the big assumption, of course, is that these natural laws fit into our categories of like civil law, moral law, logical law, aesthetic law.
But do they really, I mean, when you think about the laws of thermodynamics, that's not exactly a moral commandment.
Exactly. And so if something extraordinary happens that we call a violation of natural law, that doesn't automatically make it a breach of ethics or of logic.
Right.
It just means it's something that falls outside of our normal experience of how the natural world works.
Gotcha.
And as we see in the Bible, these sorts of extraordinary events are often attributed to God's power and purpose.
Right.
So this premise that, you know, violations are all bad things really doesn't hold up when we're talking about natural law and God potentially acting within that.
So really, both of these deductive arguments are trying to squeeze God into the limitations of our human understanding and how we think about rules, how we think about violations.
Yeah.
And it's probably not that simple.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about David Hume and his inductive argument against miracles. This one really focuses on probability, which I feel like gets into some more practical considerations about what we can really say we can believe.
Yeah. So Hume's core argument is that experience is really our only guide when we're trying to figure out how things work and make judgments about what's likely or unlikely. And he says these natural laws are established because they're based on consistent, unvarying experience.
Right.
And he says, okay, even our belief in the testimony of other people, witnesses, you know, is based on the fact that what they usually report agrees with those patterns of experience.
Okay, so that makes sense.
But since miracles by definition go against those firmly established natural laws, then that means that they contradict the very evidence that we use to determine what a fact even is.
Yeah.
So therefore, he says, only accept the testimony of a miracle if the alternative explanation, which is that the natural law wasn't violated at all, would be even more improbable.
Wow. Even more miraculous.
Even more miraculous, yeah.
So it's almost like saying you should only believe in a miracle if not believing in it would require an even bigger leap of faith.
Right.
Okay, I think I'm following. Now, this whole thing about experience being a guide, that's definitely a strong point that's something to take seriously. But I guess the question is that the only thing that can be a source of knowledge?
Right, yeah. And that idea that our direct sensory experience is the only source of knowledge, that's pure empiricism. And that's a whole philosophical debate in itself.
Okay.
But even within, you know, religious traditions, there's this question of, okay, well, how do we actually know if something that somebody is saying is divine is really true? And surprisingly, the Bible actually gives us some guidance on this.
It does, yeah.
So Dr. Newman points to several passages, for instance, Galatians chapter 6, Paul talks about testing your own actions to see if they line up with what's right.
Okay.
In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, we're told not to quench the spirit or despise prophecy, but to test everything and hold fast to what is good.
Okay.
1 John chapter 4, test the spirits to see if they're from God.
Gotcha.
And then in the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy, we see some criteria for evaluating prophets. Deuteronomy 13 says, even if a prophet performs signs and wonders, if their message is leading people away from God, then you don't accept those signs as validation.
Gotcha.
And then Deuteronomy 18 says, if the prophet's predictions don't come true, then the Lord hasn't spoken through them.
Okay. So even within a framework of faith, there is this real emphasis on not just blindly accepting things, but actually applying some critical thinking and evaluation.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm with you. Now, let's go back for a minute to this idea that Hume was talking about,
mm-hmm.
that natural laws are based on what he called unalterable experience.
Yeah.
How does that really hold up? I mean, especially when you're thinking about events that are, by their very nature, outside of that normal experience.
Well, the problem is that that statement seems to just inherently assume that miracles have never happened.
Right.
You know, if you're defining a natural law based only on the fact that nobody's ever seen an exception, then anything that looks like a miracle is automatically going to get ruled out as violating that definition.
Whoa,
it's circular reasoning. It's begging the question against miracles.
It is building the conclusion right into the starting point.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there's this piece about the reliability of witnesses. Hume said, we trust witnesses when their reports line up with, you know, what we consider facts. How does that actually work when we're talking about things that are, by definition, extraordinary?
Well, Hume rightly says, look, we should be more skeptical when we hear extraordinary claims.
Yeah, totally.
And Dr. Newman gives us a helpful illustration for this. Think about your level of skepticism. You know, if somebody told you that they saw your good friend do something unusual versus if they said, hey, I saw the president of the United States do this versus, oh, I saw Ben Franklin come back from the dead versus I saw God do this thing.
Right.
your level of skepticism is going to be different depending on how outlandish the claim is.
Right, of course.
Right. So things like the number of witnesses, their character, their reputation for honesty, you know, are they motivated to lie? All those things become really important factors.
That makes total sense. The weight of the evidence has to match how wild the claim is.
Right.
Hume's final point that we should only accept a miracle if all other possible explanations are even more miraculous. That just seems like an impossibly high bar, like you'd never actually get there.
Well, it is, yeah. You know, to say you'll only accept a miracle if everything else is even more unbelievable basically means you'll never accept
All
one.
right.
Because, you know, there's always the possibility, even if it's remote, that the witnesses were mistaken or they're lying or that there's some natural explanation that we haven't discovered yet.
Right.
So, you know, his framework almost seems designed to rule out miracles from the start, no matter what evidence you present.
Right. It just seems like a very rigid skepticism that could be just as limiting as not thinking critically at all.
Exactly.
Okay. So while Hume brings up these really important points about evidence and critical thinking, it just may be that his whole system is a little too restrictive when we're dealing with these unique events that might have causes beyond just the natural world. Okay, let's move on to Immanuel Kant. He comes at this from a whole other direction, focusing on the practical relevance, or you could say irrelevance, of miracles.
So Kant's whole philosophy centers on the idea that we can only know the world as it appears to us, the phenomenal realm, and not the world as it is in itself, the noumenal realm. So because of that, he says claims about God and a transcendent reality, including miracles, are just speculation. They're beyond what we can know for sure.
Right.
So he says, look, we might assume that God exists, you know, to give us a basis for morality. But he says genuine religious faith, you know, real faith that focuses on fulfilling our ethical duties, doesn't actually need to believe in miracles.
Okay.
He actually worries that relying on miracles could even corrupt our motives, make them self-serving instead of being driven by this pure sense of duty.
Right.
And he also argues that miracles are kind of a problematic category in the first place.
Okay.
You know, if they happen daily, they're just natural. If they happen rarely, we can't really know them, so maybe they just never really occur.
Okay. So for Kant, miracles are either ordinary, they're unknowable, or they're unnecessary. And they could even be a bad thing for authentic faith. How do people who believe in miracles actually respond to that?
Well, the first response is often to point out that there's a kind of self-contradiction in this whole argument about the limits of knowledge. Because how can we definitively say we can't know things as they truly are without having some idea of what knowing reality even means?
Right.
It's kind of a paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, it does feel like a bit of a catch-22.
Yeah. And the point from a theistic perspective is that if there is a God who does have knowledge of ultimate reality, then that God could certainly choose to reveal truths to us, even if we're limited in our understanding.
Right. If we are, in fact, creations of a creator God, communication wouldn't be out of the question.
Right.
Okay, now what about that idea of postulating God for morality, but then not needing miracles?
Well, it's true that you can certainly see God as a foundation for morality.
Right.
But as C.S. Lewis argued in Pilgrim's Progress, if that's not grounded in some actual reality, it's a pretty weak foundation. When somebody comes along and says, well, so what? So what if it's a helpful idea for society? Does that actually mean that God is real?
Right. Because if there's nothing really there besides just a useful concept, then anything you try to build on that is going to feel arbitrary and shaky.
Yep.
Okay, let's go back to that whole dilemma of miracles being daily, seldom, or never. What's the way to think about that?
The response here is that miracles might be these rare events, but that doesn't mean that they're automatically unknowable or irrelevant.
Okay.
So Dr. Newman gives a couple of examples in the Bible where there are these highly improbable events that happen, and there are specific verifiable details, you know, that make it really hard to come up with a natural explanation. So, for example, he mentions Gideon's fleece in Judges chapter 6, where dew appears and disappears on the fleece, but not the surrounding ground, and then it's reversed in a very specific sequence.
Okay.
And then there's the account of the Ark of the Covenant returning in 1 Samuel chapter 6, where these untrained cows, they're separated from their calves, and they pull this heavy ark directly towards Beth Shemesh. You know, it goes against their natural instincts.
Right.
He also points out that in 1 Samuel 3, it's mentioned that in Samuel's time, hearing directly from God was actually considered rare. So even the Bible itself acknowledges that these dramatic divine interventions aren't necessarily happening all the time.
Right. So it's not like every time you turn around, something crazy is happening.
Right. So these are events that, you know, he says, exhaust the probabilities of just natural coincidence.
Right. Those are really good examples. Mm-hmm. Those details are really specific. And it's hard to imagine those just being flukes, you know, or random natural occurrences.
Right.
Okay. And that final point about true religion needing no miracles. What about that one?
Well, the key to answering that comes down to how you understand human nature.
Okay.
So in a perfect world, maybe a relationship with God wouldn't need those dramatic interventions.
Right.
But the Christian perspective is that humanity is now separated from God. We can't consistently live up to God's standards on our own.
Right.
So we need this kind of redemptive miracle, the atonement through Christ and the regeneration of the human heart, to bridge that gap.
Mm.
So from that viewpoint, the miracles in Scripture are pointing to this God who is able and willing to intervene in human history for our salvation.
Right.
So really, miracles are only irrelevant if you have a belief system that doesn't think we need redemption in the first place.
That's really interesting. That really kind of reframes how we think about their significance. Okay, so we've covered deductive arguments, we've talked about probability, we've talked about relevance. Now, let's talk about Adolf von Harnack and this idea that miracles were just ancient ignorance.
Okay, so Harnack's argument was that people in the ancient world, they didn't really understand the natural world.
Right.
So they attributed ordinary events to supernatural causes and thought that miracles were common. So he says the miracles in the Bible aren't really supernatural. They're just reflecting that primitive worldview.
This is basically saying they just didn't know any better. They didn't have science yet.
Right. But the response to this is to point out that, yeah, okay, our scientific understanding has evolved. But even in ancient times, there were different beliefs about how often miracles happened. You had groups like the Epicureans and the Sadducees who didn't believe in miracles.
Right.
And even within the Bible, you know, not every important religious figure performed miracles. For example, John the Baptist, in John 10.41, it says he did no signs.
Okay, so there was at least some degree of discernment happening even back then.
Right, exactly. And even the Sadducees, who were generally skeptical, they acknowledged that Jesus did perform miracles. You see this in passages like John 9:11, Acts 4.
That's a really interesting point. So if even the doubters were saying, okay, something happened here
right.
that was outside of the norm, it's hard to just write it off as, oh, they just didn't understand.
Right. And Dr. Newman points out that the attempts to reinterpret Jesus's miracles as natural events often end up being really strained.
Okay.
You know, walking on water becomes walking on a sandbar. Feeding the 5,000 becomes everybody just happened to have packed a lunch.
Right.
So those kinds of explanations often require more of a leap of faith than just saying, okay, maybe a miracle happened.
Sometimes those explanations are more miraculous than the miracles themselves.
Yeah.
All right. So we've covered quite a lot of ground here. Let's talk finally about Rudolf Bultmann and this whole argument about the closed universe.
Mm.
This one really brings that modern scientific viewpoint right into the heart of the conversation.
Okay. So Bultmann argued that modern science and history are working on the assumption that the universe is a closed system of cause and effect.
Okay.
He says, look, we rely on technology that's built on those principles, right?
Right.
And this modern worldview that natural events have natural causes is more mature than the ancient view, where God or demons were messing around with everything.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, no room for miracles in that.
So you're saying in this modern scientific view, there's just no space for anything like a supernatural intervention.
Well, that's the implication. But while it's true that science and history mostly work within this framework of methodological naturalism, that we look for natural explanations for natural events, that's a chosen method, it doesn't automatically prove that the universe is a completely closed system, you know, with no possibility of anything acting from outside.
Okay.
We've still got big questions about where the universe came from in the first place and how life began. And lots of people point to the apparent design in the universe as evidence for something beyond natural processes.
Right. And it seems like that's a really important distinction, that science has its way of looking at things, but that doesn't necessarily rule out that there might be something more going on.
Right. And, you know, the fact that we use modern technology doesn't mean that you can't believe in God.
Right.
You know, throughout history, lots of Christians and other religious people have been at the forefront of scientific discoveries.
Right.
And the response also acknowledges that, you know, maybe in the past people were a little too quick to say that God or demons were directly causing everyday events.
Okay.
But the Bible itself doesn't always say that God acts without any kind of intermediary.
Right.
And it doesn't blame all problems on Satan either.
Okay.
So it's a more nuanced understanding that recognizes both the regularities of the natural world, but also the possibility of, you know, occasional supernatural intervention.
Right. So there's a balance there.
Oh.
Okay. So what about the evidence for divine intervention, especially in light of this whole closed universe idea?
Well, Dr. Newman points out that there's actually quite a bit of evidence that believers find compelling.
Okay.
And this is something that's explored in their apologetics courses and also on their website, iberi.org.
Okay.
So, for instance, there are arguments for divine intervention in creation itself.
Okay.
Looking at the fine-tuning of the universe, the complexity of life, how well it aligns with the Genesis 1 account.
Right.
There's also the question of divine intervention in history. So looking at things like the unique origin of the nation of Israel, fulfilled prophecy, the rise of Christianity, the events surrounding Jesus's life and death and resurrection.
Right.
And he contrasts that with attempts like Thomas Jefferson's, where they tried to edit the Gospels and take out all the supernatural elements.
Right.
And then even in the present day, there's the whole phenomenon of personal and societal transformation, which some people see as evidence of God still working in the world.
Right.
So while Christians might disagree about how often miracles happen today or what form they take, the idea that people and even whole societies can undergo these really radical changes is seen by some as evidence of divine intervention.
It's really interesting to think about. Well, this has been quite a journey, hasn't it?
It has.
We've really walked through some of these major arguments against miracles.
Huh.
And I think the takeaway here is that while these objections raise important questions, they make us think really hard about things, they're not necessarily these insurmountable obstacles.
That's right. I mean, by looking at the assumptions behind the arguments and offering some alternative perspectives, you know, you can come up with some pretty compelling responses.
Yeah. And it really highlights, you know, just how complex this issue is.
It is.
But doesn't mean that miracles are automatically off the table.
Right.
So for you listening, we really want to encourage you to spend some time thinking about these different arguments and responses.
Mm.
What really stood out to you? What questions does this raise for you? You know, engaging in these kinds of discussions can really help us refine how we think about these extraordinary claims.
Yeah. And on that note, I think here's a final thought to chew on. You know, if the universe isn't definitively a closed system, as Boltzmann and others suggest, what does that mean for how we understand not just those things that we call miracles, but also the nature of reality itself and our place in it? You know, if you're interested in going deeper, I really encourage you to check out those resources, especially iberi.org.
Yeah, that's great. And thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
All right. We'll see you next time.
See you then.